Good morning, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, the pick is in. Now that he is officially the Republican nominee, Donald Trump has selected J.D. Vance as his running mate. What does the junior senator from Ohio bring to the table? Also this morning, as difficult questions continue to be asked surrounding this weekend's shooting at a Trump rally in Pennsylvania, it's already apparent that the entire incident represents a significant failure by the Secret Service. And July is Disability Pride Month, commemorating the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act and now 34 years ago. A conversation with one advocate working to bring more authentic representation to Hollywood and why that's important. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Tuesday, July 16th, 2024. So it has been a very stressful few days. Obviously, we've had a lot of things that have been making headlines, not always positive news, and it's just been very stressful. Have you ever been so stressed out that you have said to yourself, I could just cry? I could just go into a corner someplace and cry. But you hold back the tears because people are watching. You know, you don't want to have people see you break down. Well, now we have the answer. In New York City, there is a new place where people can let it all out in private. It is called the Sob Parlor. The Sob Parlor. It offers a private room complete with comfortable furniture and the appropriate mood music, among other things, for your own 30-minute blubber session. You can go and rent a room to just cry, have a good cry. An Instagram post from March lists the cost of a session at $20. $20 for a session, according to this Instagram post. Research shows that a good cry is actually good for both mental and physical well-being. Harvard Health notes that emotional tears flush stress hormones and other toxins out of our system. So there is something to this. Additionally, having a good cry releases oxytocin and other endorphins, feel-good chemicals that help ease both physical and emotional pain. So there is something to it. Now you can go and have yourself a good cry. Nobody... You don't have to feel guilty about it. Nobody has to know. One of the reasons why we are so stressed out is because life is so complicated these days. Are you nostalgic for days of yore when you were younger, when you had fewer cares in the world? I think we all have those moments where we wish that we could go back to when times were simpler. And there is something to this, according to a recent paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research. As far back as 1973, they say, happiness tended to follow a U-shaped curve, with peak happiness occurring during young adulthood, when you were in your 20s. Doesn't really matter how old you are or when you were in your 20s. It just that time of life, people tended to believe was the happiest time of life. And this has been a longstanding, like 50 years, for 50 years, this has been the case where we have this U-shaped curve of happiness with peak happiness happening in young adulthood and then dipping until you get to old age when it kind of upticks again. But this U-shaped happiness curve appears to be changing. This paper, again from the NBER, shows that life satisfaction is now more linear and slowly increases with age. That means young adulthood is no longer one of the happiest times in a person's life. That's when people are just starting their lives. It shouldn't be when they are most anxious, the most depressed, and have no hope for the future, according to Carol Graham of the Brookings Institution, asked to comment on this report. They say it is a concerning trend, and it is not just in this country. In 34 different countries around the world, seeing similar results. Kind of interesting. I think for most people, if you look back, we're nostalgic for that period of our lives, but maybe future generations won't have that same nostalgia, so we don't view it as the happiest time of life. Kind of interesting. Some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started. The population of the world will hit its peak in 2080. A new report from the United Nations says, after we hit our peak global population in the year 2080, the population is predicted to decline. The current world population is 8.2 billion people. 8.2 billion on planet Earth. It is expected to reach a peak population of 10.8 billion in 2080. It goes on to say this report, some countries like South Korea, Italy, and Spain are already seeing lower birth rates. China, Germany, and Japan have already reached their peak populations. The UN says the decline in population from 2080 onward could mean reduced environmental pressures from human impacts due to lower aggregate consumption. I'm wondering, again, we're talking about 2080 here, is when the Earth's population will begin to decline. I wonder if that will be because we are colonizing other planets. Fewer people on Earth, but more people like on Mars or living on the moon or something like that. I don't know, but they say population decline or population will, global population will hit its peak in 2080, and then after that will trail off. Let's see. There's still some summer left. I know we've been talking about back to school and all of that. It is that time of the year, especially with Prime Day happening today. I know a lot of folks would be doing some back to school shopping for Prime Day. And even though we're starting to think in those terms now, there's still plenty of summer left. Have you had your summer vacation yet? If you have not, if you are still planning your summer vacation, you should probably know this. You want to get to Disneyland sometime within the next month. Park officials say six major attractions are going to close next month. So time is running short to ride Space Mountain, Disneyland Railroad, the Disneyland Monorail, Animation Academy, Turtle Talk with Crush, and Anna and Elsa's Royal Welcome. They will all temporarily close in August as part of Disneyland's standard refurbishment schedule. Previous closures include the Haunted Mansion, Splash Mountain, Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, Davy Crockett's Explorer Canoes, and Redwood Creek Challenge Trail have been shuttered for refurbishment and apparently are getting set to reopen. But I just want to let you know, if you have a family trip to Disneyland, now this is again Disneyland in California, not Walt Disney World in Florida, different schedule for refurbishment there, but in Disneyland, California, those six attractions going to close next month. I don't want you to be disappointed when you get there and the moose outside tells you the rides are closed. Sorry, folks. Ride's closed. Moose out front should have told you. let's see. And finally, lastly this morning, among the first things that you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. We're talking about all of the stresses and going off and having yourself a good cry. And we talk about family vacation to Disneyland or theme park or what have you. You know, that's one of the things that can actually help de-stress you and rejuvenate you. Get away from the screen and get out into the real world. Take your family on vacation or whatever. Take them to an amusement park or just take them to any park. The negative impact that screen time has on mental health has been well documented, particularly screen addicted adolescents. But a new study out of the University of Southern Denmark shows how quickly that mental health impact of too much screen time can be reversed, how quickly you can turn that around. Most young people today spend as many as 8 hours on their digital devices, scrolling and clicking and all of that. But this study used 181 children, or used 180, that sounds right. The study involved 181 children who reduced their screen time, and they were talking about just leisure screen time. School-related screen time was not counted. So these, I mean, because kids are going to have to spend some time in front of screens because of, you know, the way school is, education is these days. So some screen time is going to be required. So what they did is they reduced their leisure screen time to just 3 hours per week for 2 weeks. So an hour a day, three times a week for 2 weeks. The researchers noted that in that two-week span, just 2 weeks, the digital detox led to significant improvements in these children's behavior and their mental health. The study's authors say the results highlight that positive mental effects can be achieved by just taking a short break from screen media use as a family. That is the key. Doing something together as a family. So I think this is research that we could file under the category of things that we kind of know inherently, but it's always good to have verifiable research back up what we kind of feel is already the case and just kind of confirms what we already knew. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Showers and storms possible today with a high in the mid-80s. A chance of a storm tonight, a low around 70. Registration is now open for volunteer teams looking to lend a hand and agencies seeking help with projects through the United Way of Hancock County's Fall Days of Caring. The three-day volunteer event will take place September 16th through the 18th. Keith from Marathon volunteered at a previous Days of Caring event.
We'd like to just give back to the community, Marathon being a central figure here in Findlay. And today we're out here just putting together a gazebo for the city mission. For them to have a little shade out here in the sunlight, getting a little fresh air.
Corporate groups are the most common team makeup for Days of Caring, but any group can volunteer, whether it be a classroom of students, a church group, or even a group of friends. Get more details about the United Way's Days of Caring in the story on our website. Ohio is seeking to protect youth from the dangers of vaping.
Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost has launched a campaign to combat the influx of illegal vaping devices in Ohio. Yost says this is designed to protect young people from addiction, respiratory problems, and other health risks. Illegal vape devices and related products may cause further harm because they contain chemicals that are harmful and not approved for sale. Vape shops in Orville, Delaware, and Cincinnati have been specifically targeted for deceptive practices.
ONN's Clay Gordon reporting. Owens Community College Findlay Area Campus Dean Brad Wood was among the 35 graduates in the most recent Ohio Leadership Academy for Student Success class. The academy, sponsored by the Ohio Association of Community Colleges, annually gathers faculty and staff for a year of training, exchanging ideas, and immersion in promoting student success. Wood said the past year has provided him a meaningful and positive professional development experience with colleagues from around the state. And he says they shared practical experiences that can be adapted to their daily work and help their students succeed and achieve their high education goals. Get more in the story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online at WFIN.com.
Well, late breaking news yesterday afternoon as former President Trump, now officially the Republican nominee for the November election, announced the junior senator from Ohio, J.D. Vance, as his running mate. And joining us once again is Professor Alan Sanders, former Time Magazine senior reporter and professor emeritus of political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey. J.D. Vance, an interesting pick, although not necessarily a surprising one. We knew he was on the short list. It will be a very popular selection here in Ohio, particularly. But I'm curious, as an observer from outside the Buckeye State, what is your take on this pick?
Well, hello, Chris. Well, I guess it's sort of mixed kind of an assessment, as is true for any vice presidential pick. On the positive side, of course, he is popular in Ohio, and Ohio presumably will go Trump's way. Also, many of the battleground states surround Ohio and their neighboring states. Certainly J.D. Vance appeals to the MAGA base. He's a very strong MAGA supporter. And so one can expect that the MAGA base in the surrounding states will come out full swing in support of J.D. Vance. And, you know, the Trump people are counting heavily on that MAGA turnout.
Yeah.
So that's the positive side. On the negative side, J.D. Vance is a very controversial figure. He's made some very controversial statements about abortion, about immigration, about climate change. And he was one of the first people in the aftermath of the assassination attempt against Trump to suggest that Biden's rhetoric led to the attempted assassination. That's
right.
A really controversial statement. And particularly in light of all the people who have said we need to tamp down rhetoric. This is not the kind of rhetoric that tamps down anything.
Yeah.
So you've got the positives and you've got the negatives, and we'll have to see how it works out.
I mentioned it's an interesting pick for a couple of reasons, I think. Number one, because he hasn't been involved in politics for very long, only having taken office in January of last year, and he's gone through exactly one campaign. Then again, of course, Donald Trump himself didn't have any political experience up until the time he was elected president. Still, are you a bit surprised that Trump didn't go with someone with a little more experience?
Well, you know, I think Trump is a showbiz kind of guy. We certainly know that he pays a lot of attention to the parameters of show business. And J.D. Vance is young. He's attractive. He's aggressive in the rhetoric that he uses. He presents well. And I suppose he looks like the young vice president, the heir apparent if the Republicans win this election. So I think that played a major role. I think the youth element is also important because, as we know, age has become a big issue, not just for Biden, but also for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that went into the mix as well. But I think most important of all, J.D. Vance has made clear that he is a complete MAGA convert. He wasn't at the beginning of his political life. He was a never Trumper. But he made it clear that he had a change of mind. He reassessed. And now he's gone really full swing in favor of MAGA Republicanism.
Yeah.
So I think Trump certainly likes that an awful lot, particularly when somebody says, I'm a convert. You converted me. You made me believe in you. And I think that also played a very important part.
Well,
one other aspect.
Yeah.
J.D. Vance was supported by Donald Trump Jr. And as we know, the elder Trump pays a lot of attention to what his children say and what they think. They have a large influence on him as well. So all of that, I think, played a role.
You mentioned, and that was the other point that I was going to bring up, that certainly Vance early on in the run-up to the 2016 presidential race was a very harsh critic of Donald Trump, calling him reprehensible even, declaring himself a never-Trump guy, and certainly has changed his tune since. And it's interesting because flip-flopping that dramatically is usually not a successful strategy for a politician, especially with someone like Donald Trump. You mentioned that, that revelation, that epiphany obviously sat well with Donald Trump. But why do you think he has been able to pull off that 100-degree turnabout with the electorate?
Well, I think you can pull that, epiphany kind of moment when you're running for a lower office. It's a lot easier to say, look, I thought this way. Now I've rethought the question and I've rethought the issue. I've seen new evidence that leads me to believe that I should now go this route politically. That's at the lower level if we're running for the Senate. At the presidential level, we'll have to see whether that works. I mean, I think you can expect that the Democrats will play all of that up and point out, well, you were never Trumper. Now you say you're a MAGA. You have sort of a revelatory moment. Can we believe anything you say? What other revelatory moments are you going to have down the road? And when you get the whole press on you at the top of the ticket going after you on these sorts of questions and the Democrats attack, I think that produces a different kind of dynamic. So that's another danger. I mean, the positive is that he said, I saw the light. The negative is, did you really see the light? And what other lights are you going to be seeing in the future? That's what the Democrats will play out.
A lot of times a vice presidential selection is made based on a perceived weakness of the presidential candidate to try and shore up support in maybe an area that is underrepresented or underaccounted for at the top of the ticket. Does J.D. Vance bring anything to the table? I mean, outside of the fact, as you mentioned, that he is young, he is it's been pointed out, he is the first millennial to be on a presidential ticket for either party. I guess that's got to account for something, as you mentioned, especially in an election where age is an issue. But beyond that, does he bring anything unique to the table that Donald Trump was missing?
Well, I think from Donald Trump's standpoint, his belief is that the MAGA base is enough to win the election. You've got to energize the MAGA base, and there's enough of them out there, if they come out, certainly in the swing states, to yield a successful election victory for you. He's not the kind of politician who believes that you broaden the party appeal. He doesn't believe that that's very useful to him. He just needs to win those swing states, and so if he can just bring out all of the MAGA supporters to the polls, he believes that that's enough. And from his standpoint, J.D. Vance fits that bill. He is a total MAGA supporter at this point in his career. He's very eloquent and aggressive in advocating those positions, and his youth certainly doesn't hurt. But I think it's the point of view that MAGA is the key to success, and I think that's probably what dominated Donald Trump's assessment.
No, he certainly is also well-spoken, as you mentioned. That is for sure. Some people may not like what he says, but he is very eloquent in that respect. Also have to ask how this affects Ohio. I mean, should he be elected to the vice presidency, the governor would then appoint a successor in the Senate. There would be a special election in November of 2026. Some time ago, I heard one analyst suggest that this could represent a do-over for whoever loses the Senate race between Sherrod Brown and Bernie Moreno, which everybody is watching very closely.
Well, that's right. I think in the short run, it doesn't change the partisan makeup from Ohio to the U.S. Senate,
right,
the governor will appoint. But it does set up a race down the road. And of course, it's hard to predict the dynamics of that race because whoever wins the presidency will affect that political climate.
Good point.
So it's really very tough to speculate about what it means. But certainly in the short run, it doesn't change the partisan representation of Ohio in the Senate at this point.
Very, very good point. It is interesting to note that the Ohio Republican Party, the state Republican Party, seems to have a very deep bench of potential candidates for either appointment or for a special election on down the line. The ranks seem to be thinner among state Democrats right now. So, again, will be a very interesting race to watch should that eventuality develop. Again, Professor Alan Sanders is with us, former Time Magazine senior reporter, professor emeritus of political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey. Always a pleasure. Professor Sanders, thanks very much for your insight. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Chris. A pleasure for myself, too. Take care.
Well, the attempted assassination of Donald Trump over the weekend clearly represents a significant failure by the Secret Service, a breach of security that is raising serious questions about how a gunman managed to scale the roof of a building so close to the stage where the rally was going on and have an unobstructed view His target and the former president. Brian Boyd is a 30-plus year professional intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist, and law enforcement professional. He has served with the Departments of Defense, Justice, and the Treasury. And Brian, I've been trying hard not to get ahead of the facts in this case, knowing that there will be more that will come out as Congress is already scheduling hearings to get the answers that everybody is seeking here. And I don't want to disparage all of the good work that the Secret Service has done to protect presidents and former presidents and their families. But certainly they are not above reproach. And as we said, clearly this was, at a minimum, a severe miscalculation.
Yes, but I'm not going to classify it as a security breach. This is never a breach. This is a massive security failure. If you listen to what they said, that was outside their perimeter, so nothing was breached. But what they did fail to do, and if you think of this as a layman, and you're rehearsing a president coming on stage, let's pretend you're standing on the stage, and you're looking around the perimeter, and if you see a building within a couple hundred yards that doesn't have any security on it, in it, or around it, and that's outside the perimeter, wouldn't that be a logical thing even for a basic Army trainee that that's a position that needs to be secured? And it was not. So that's a major security failure. They didn't secure the building in any fashion. Think about it. And then if you think about the police officer who supposedly climbed the roof and he tries to confront this guy and he backs off, there's a communication breakdown because what he observed and saw, and I'm assuming something in this case, his comms don't connect directly to the Secret Service earpieces. So what he's doing is he's relaying, and if he did give a mayday call or a failure of a man on a roof and dispatched it, there's a breakdown between state, local communications to the Secret Service people, and that happens to be in the comms center, and that was not relayed in time to warn the Secret Service detail with their earpieces to get the president off the stage. So these are preventable. These are screw-ups. These are security failures.
We always learn things when tragedies happen or near tragedies happen. I mean, fortunately, obviously, the former president was not seriously injured. What will be the lessons out of this? Again, there's a lot that still has yet to come out, but based on just what we know now, what are the lessons to be learned here?
Well, the lessons come from the top down. In recent history, when the Secret Service used to be part of the Treasury, because their job and their legal authority is to arrest counterfeiters. They don't have any arrest procedures or process for assassins. They're detailed to the President of the United States. So historically, they are counterfeit agents. And somewhere down the road, they probably should change it. And then when they put them under the Homeland Security, they create a massive bureaucratic overhead structure, which has not enhanced their communications or their ability to get things done, in my opinion. It might be a good logical step to take the Secret Service as an executive office directed to the president, divest them of the counterfeiting, and make them basically a security detail for the president, and then have direct control over them. I think that would be a nice, massive change.
It has been pointed out that the security measures for former presidents and for presidential candidates, and in this case, Donald Trump is both, that the security measures are not the same as for sitting presidents. Should they be? I mean, is that going to be one of the questions moving forward?
Yeah, that's a normal question to ask, and should the other questions be asked? There's been complacency over the years because Trump rallies are never violent, although the one on January 6th is an anomaly, in my opinion. But they, you know, are usually pretty peaceful. They're loving. They pick up their trash. They don't leave junk around. So this is something outside what they probably expected. But again, it's a physical security failure. And that's what it was not a breach. It's a physical security failure.
Mm-hmm.
And the other side of the coin is there should have been air coverage in some form. And thinking about this thing where Kennedy, who's a presidential nominee, has been denied presidential security, and that bothers me because his brother and his uncle were assassinated.
Yeah.
He's a certain prime target.
Talking about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. One of the other points that has been brought up is the fact that there is this constant back and forth between the Secret Service and campaign officials as to where the line should be drawn. Candidates do certainly need to be seen. They need to be out there and to a certain degree accessible by large crowds of people. And the security detail generally tries to be as inconspicuous as possible. How much of that is likely to change as a result of this incident?
I don't honestly see that as a problem. If you've been to any of these rallies, it doesn't matter who, whether it's Republican or Democratic, and you watch over the years as to how they're handled, the people in the campaign all want to be out to be able to shake hands and touch and feel. And that's always a problem for Secret Service, whether they're working a rope line or they're working something else. But most assassination attempts have been up close, much like the Reagan attempt, or long-range rifles, much like Kennedy. So those are the two scenarios that they try to prepare for, long distance or short range, or up and close and personal. So the campaign people, the Secret Service understand that, and I don't think there's a real conflict. But again, if you look at this particular event, this is a failure of competence. And it's an incompetent issue. It was never, that should not have been left as a hole within that short range. So that was a hole in the area.
Yeah.
That to me is an incompetence issue.
What about in the near term? I mean, obviously, the Republican convention is happening this week. The Democrats will hold their convention next month. How nimble is the Secret Service in beefing up security measures for these events, which obviously are different scenarios than the environment of what we saw on Saturday? But at the same time, you know, obviously, there has to be some greater concern. Now,
well, if you look at the different scenarios, the police chief of Milwaukee has said that they have prepared for that event for 18 months. That's been on the books for a long time. They've had lots of time to prepare for that, building metal barricades, etc. These rallies are relatively short, in short warnings. If you think about the resources of the Secret Service, they're sort of stretched thin. They work long tours. They work long hours, they do long shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the guys on the roof in 100-degree heat, snipers, how many times you have to rotate those guys because you're on a hot tin roof without a cover. But, you know, think about the problem on that. Those guys been there since, what, 7 a.m. in the morning?
Yeah, yeah.
So these are physical issues that have so much to do with it. But I think that's much of the issue. And I guess if you don't mind me segueing, this has very little to do with the motive of the shooter. It has to do with the fact that anybody could have done that because of that hole in that security.
Yeah. Well, and at the end of the day, the motive is secondary to the function of protecting the president, or in this case, the former president. So certainly that a point well taken, that this is a conversation separate from what may or may not have motivated this particular shooter. Again, Brian Boyd is a 30-plus year professional intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist, law enforcement professional. Really interesting stuff in terms of dialing into what exactly the failures were here based on what we know at this point. Brian, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate your insight in this.
It's a privilege to talk with you, Chris. God bless America.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
I do not believe that we have a story out of Florida in the broken news today. It is very unusual, very rare, that we don't have a story out of Florida. It seems like they're always doing weird things. We do, however, have a story out of California, which is the other weirdness hotspot in the country, of course. The Orange County Sheriff's Department is warning of a so-called hugging robber, or a pair of hugging robbers. Hugging robbers. This after a robbery attempt in Rancho Santa Margarita earlier this month. Man says that a woman got out of a car walked up his driveway with her arms out for a big hug, and then forcibly tried to take the gold chain that he was wearing around his neck. Just some random person gets out of the car, walks up the driveway, give me a hug. I think I would naturally be suspicious, but apparently this guy wasn't. Found himself robbed of his gold chain. The woman and a man who was the suspected getaway driver have since been arrested. Police say the pair may be connected with similar incidents elsewhere in Orange County and the surrounding area. The hugging robber. Finally, the reign of terror has come to an end. The hugging robbers are behind bars. Let's see. Now, this is an interesting story out of China. From the International File, thieves in China are using what law enforcement there believes is a very concerning tactic. They are using lifelike silicone face masks. These realistic products, which can be made from photos or 3D scans, are widely available online. Back in March, four homes in Shanghai were broken into, and the main suspect used such a mask to disguise himself as an old man. Another suspect, allegedly disguised as an electrician, also used a realistic mask to invade homes in Jiangsu. The key, according to a lawyer in China by the name of Liu Zhong, the key is in regulating their use. Relevant authorities, he said, should grade the realism of face masks. Here, and I thought that the most effective strategy would be to just go after the thieves who are robbing people. But no, rather than going after the thieves, they're going after the mask makers, apparently. They've got this all figured out in China. Go after the mask makers. That makes sense. Let's see. Elsewhere in the broken news, two women in Pennsylvania have been accused of stealing from their employer, a local Arby's restaurant. Shania West and Stephanie Davis now face felony charges for their alleged involvement in stealing $3,000 worth of food and drinks from the Arby's restaurant in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. $3,000 worth of food and drinks they stole. The owner of the restaurant, Linda Ray, first notified authorities when she noticed discrepancies in the log sheets on the roast beef inventory. She said she believed that Ms. West and Ms. Davis were pretending to throw away the meat because it had gone bad, but in reality, they were taking it home. Investigators say Ms. West and Ms. Davis had been taking the meats for months. Surveillance footage also suggests that the duo took 16 other food items along with 143 drinks, but it is the meat products that they are most concerned with. Kind of gives new meaning to the slogan, "We have the meats." These two were saying, "We have the meats now. We have the meats." It would have to be an Arby's restaurant, right? "We have the meats." Police in the state of Washington say that they are trained to handle just about any situation that arises, but a wallaby on the loose is not necessarily something that they are formally trained for. Nonetheless, that is exactly what they encountered when they responded to a dispatch call alerting them to the 2.5-foot marsupial with big ears and tiny forearms that was running loose. Wallaby on the loose. A video obtained by the Seattle Times shows the Washington State Patrol troopers making several unsuccessful attempts to corral the wallaby before one trooper was finally able to tackle it and take it into custody. The Pierce County Sheriff's Department Sergeant Darren Moss said in a statement that the wallaby was corralled safely, not injured. The animal was returned, according to the report, to its home at Debbie Doolittle's Petting Zoo, which is near where it was found. At least they thought they returned it home to Debbie Doolittle's Petting Zoo near where the wallaby was found. But wait, there's a twist to the story. Officials at the petting zoo say, that's not our wallaby. We've never seen that wallaby before. So, who knows? It's their wallaby now. You keep track of it. It's not their wallaby. How many wallabies can there be running around in Seattle? It's weird. And finally, in the broken news this morning, and we'll end on a happy note. This is such a sweet story. A 100-year-old woman is celebrating after finally getting her diploma from Farrington High School in Honolulu. Ethel Nishimoto was denied a graduation ceremony in the aftermath of the Pearl Harbor attack in 1941 because of her Japanese heritage. Sunday was her 100th birthday, and to celebrate the milestone, Ethel's family surprised her with her high school diploma thanks to the help of today's officials at Farrington High School. They recognized the error of their ways. Better late than never, I guess. They even had a cap and gown for Ethel to wear as she accepted the diploma 82 years after the fact at the age of 100. That is all kinds of awesome. Never too late to turn a wrong into a right. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Did you know more than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio for their news, traffic, weather, sports, and a community connection? AM radio is the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping Americans safe in dangerous times. This is News Director Matt Demchak. AM 1330 WFIN is here to serve you, and we take seriously our commitment to our listeners. We would love to hear what you value most about AM radio. Visit WeAreBroadcasters.com and tell us how you depend on AM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Back to school spending this year is expected to be flat or even a little lower than last year. Shoppers are scaling back their purchase of expensive electronics like laptops and personal computers. This, according to the latest study, the latest survey results from Deloitte, they say shoppers are estimated to spend $31.3 billion total, which works out to about $586 per student for K through 12. Shopper surveys give them those numbers. That compares to $31.9 billion or $497 a head last year. Shoppers are likely to spend $12.6 billion on clothing and school supplies, which is obviously the largest segment of back-to-school spending, $12.6 billion. And that is basically the same as what consumers spent last year. The big downturn comes in those technology products. Estimated spending this year will be $8.6 billion. That is 11% lower from last year's spending. When you break it down by income level, middle-income families making between $50,000 and $99,000 a year are expected to cut their spending by 9%, while low-income families making less than $50,000 could slash their spending by 4%. Meanwhile, higher-income families whose annual incomes exceed $100,000 are expected to see a 5% rise in average spending to $721 per child compared with $689 per student a year ago. So higher-income consumers making up for some of the declines in other income ranges. For the vast majority, of us in that middle income level, again, household income between $50,000 and $99,000 a year, families are focusing more on value and are willing to shop for private label off-brand products. According to Stephen Rogers, he is managing director for Deloitte Insights Consumer Industry Center, about 67% of parents in that income group may sacrifice loyalty if the preferred brand is too expensive. So, and that goes for everything from designer clothes to regular school supplies, and get the off-label brand instead of the name brand if it's significantly cheaper. Well, July is Disability Pride Month, commemorating the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act now 34 years ago. Chet Cooper is with us this morning. He is the co-founder of Ability, the first newsstand magazine focused on health and disability, and one of the world's leading advocates for employment, awareness building, and housing for people with disabilities. His latest mission is to achieve greater authentic representation in Hollywood. And Chet, why is this important, especially in the context of all the ways that we need to improve inclusion and representation in the workplace, in education, in everyday society, really? Why an emphasis on entertainment?
Well, as we all know, we watch TV and movies. Entertainment basically helps guide some of the social constructs of society that if they want to, they can push out information that might not be, let's say, positive. And I think in the world of using the term disability, it's usually been negative. And then also in the sense of hiring people, authentic actors with disabilities, mm-hmm. it's pretty much unheard of. The old narrative used to be, well, we would if we could find talent with disabilities. And what has happened is Netflix came to us, came to Ability Magazine and our job program called Ability Jobs. And they asked us for some help because they could only find 10 young actors to audition for a part in a show they were producing called Healing Powers of Dude. So we put out the call and we sent them over 500 auditions, showing that we had this reach, and it was for a young girl ages 9 to 13 that authentically used a power wheelchair. So from that, we decided, okay, we know that there's talent out there. Let's just make it permanent. So that's where Ability E came in. I don't know if you know, but 95% of the characters that are played for people with disabilities that are played are actually actors. They're just acting the part.
Yeah, I want to jump in here because that's actually kind of what I wanted to talk about. There's actually two things here. You've got the inclusion of disabled characters on screen and the inclusion of disabled performers in the portrayal of those characters. Is it on the first part, with respect to just having disabled characters included in storylines, is it the fear of the unknown, the aversion to anything different? What is it that feeds this hesitancy to write disabled characters into Hollywood stories?
Well, I think it's both. And it's also what we're trying to do is not only in front of the camera, but also behind the camera. So if you have writers that have disabilities themselves, they've lived that life. They have that authentic experience. Mm-hmm. So we're pushing the narrative that there's talent out there that has not been typically tapped into.
And that kind of leads to the next part of it, the second part of that question, why the lack of actual disabled performers in those roles, even as you were saying, when there are disabled characters that are part of a storyline, quite often you've got able-bodied individuals who are playing those roles.
Right. As I was mentioning in the history of mankind, all civil rights movements have had these problems.
Yeah.
So it's this progression of awareness and understanding and maturity within society to move these things forward. And it's taking a long time. They've all taken way too long to move forward. And so we're here trying to help nudge that major shift. And the other thing we're trying to do, not only for those parts that could use an authentic person with a disability for that part, but also why not hire talent with disabilities for other parts that do not call out that they have to have a disability? What does it matter if a person is blind or deaf or is an amputee or whatever the cognitive issue?
Yeah.
If they can play the part, they don't have to. It doesn't have to be written in. It's just part of the fabric of life and of society.
I immediately think of the young lady, and her name escapes me, who is playing a role in the Broadway version of Oklahoma. Allie Stoker, yes. Yeah. Obviously that's not a character that was written as an individual in a wheelchair, but she absolutely kills it.
Right. Yeah. So it's a strange thing when you look at the trajectory of a disability movement, how it really, it's the largest minority. It's the strangest minority because it's so broad, and it's the only minority. Other minorities and anyone can join at any minute. So it's this intersectionality. It's very, very unique. And it is, like I said earlier, the part of the fabric of life. We all eventually, unless you die instantly, our bodies start to break down.
Yeah.
So why not change those attitudes for people that are younger? Now, that's part of aging. That's just the way, life is.
And along the same lines, at the same time, helping to break down some of those stereotypes in the eyes of viewers and the consumers of this content. As you were mentioning, one of the things that entertainment has done for a long time and done very well. So it's about time to jump on board here. Again, Chet Cooper is co-founder of Ability and the Ability E platform to help facilitate entertainers to pursue their careers. Where do folks learn more about this?
Easy is probably just to go to abilitymagazine.com. So if anyone listening has a disability or has a friend that has a disability or a loved one, take a look. There's job opportunities. There's both in the entertainment industry side that we just talked about, but generally speaking, just pure jobs.
Yeah.
Ability Jobs is the largest and first job board. So abilitymagazine.com, and great stories. It's an award-winning publication. That has a lot more than you would ever think.
Again, in honor of Disability Pride Month in July, Chet Cooper, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. Check us out online at goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, should Findlay put out the welcome mat or put up a do not enter sign for legalized recreational marijuana dispensaries in the city? Findlay Mayor Christina Mern will weigh in. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.